Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Project MedTech. I'm your host, Dwayne Mancini. As always, if you need anything from the podcast or would like to suggest a future guest, please email us at info@projectmedtech.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. And you can always visit our website, www.projectmedtech.com, or follow us on LinkedIn. My guest today is Zeke Zielinski. Zeke is the president and founder of SMMG MedTech and is a sales director with Abbott Vascular. In this episode of the podcast, Zeke and I discuss SMMG MedTech, what it is, the history, selling medical device products, advice and challenges that medical device companies will face when commercializing their product, and much more. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy my discussion with Zeke Zielinski.
Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Talking about the future and what comes next with Project MedTech.
Okay, Zeke, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks, Dwayne. Appreciate being here.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, you're the founder and president of SMMG MedTech, and I believe you're also a sales executive for, oh my gosh, I'm blanking on the name already. Abbott Vascular. Right. Okay, perfect. So why don't we just give a background, your history in the space, and then also, you know, what you're doing now for Abbott, and then also I want to spend a lot of time talking about SMMG MedTech.
Sure. No problem, Dwayne.
Yeah.
I've been in the med tech industry too long, over 25 plus years, in a lot of different roles. And it's exciting because I was just reading something on LinkedIn this morning that was talking about different companies and different therapies and when they come to market. I think it was Cordis getting sold off to a private entity when they were, you know, at one point in time, Johnson & Johnson and then Cardinal Health, and then it got sold off. And it actually made me think about my career and the different pivot points I've taken in my career and tried to always capture what's the next therapy, what's the next innovative thing. And I've been very fortunate to be able to jump into those therapies in my career. So as you look back on my career, I started in the medical world with a company, C.R. Bard, which is now part of Becton Dickinson. And it was in urology. I was a sales rep in Southern California. And then from there, I got into the cardiovascular world with a company called ACS, Advanced Cardiovascular Systems. And that's when PTCA was just getting going. It was angioplasty was becoming the standard of care in the cath lab. It was still a profit center at that point in time. And so I jumped from urology to cardiology and had a great career. And then I saw this new therapy come out called Rotablator. And it was a company called Heart Technology. And again, still in Southern California, and Heart Technology had a new therapy where they were, you know, spinning a burr 180,000 RPMs and pulverizing plaque to tiny particles smaller than red blood cells. I still remember the whole pitch, you know, many years ago, differential cutting and orthogonal displacement of friction. how do you like that? I still remember
that. right.
So I spent my time as a rep with them, and then Boston Scientific bought Heart Technology in the 90s. And that's when I launched my management career. I actually went into management with Boston Scientific as a region manager in Southern California, running a team. And then eventually I got promoted into running the training department at Boston Scientific, and they moved me to Minnesota, where I live today in the Twin Cities. I've been here since 1999. And it was a very rewarding career to come inside, you know, kind of run the training department. And then we launched a great new product called Taxus, which was a drug-eluting stent that took on Cordis, J&J, Cypher. And we took it by storm with an incredible strategy of taking over the drug-eluting stent business. And then after Boston, believe it or not, I went and started the startup world here in the Twin Cities, which is an ecosystem, which is kind of how SMMG comes to be. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. But I came to Minnesota knowing that there was an ecosystem here in the Twin Cities of really good companies. And so it helped me formulate why I wanted to come to Minneapolis back in 99. And I went with a series of different startups, one called Coaxia, which was an ischemic stroke product. Then I went to AngioTech and ran sales for them. And then I went to LifeWatch and did some Holter monitors. A buddy of mine invented a product called SecureCath, interventional radiologist. I was with Intrarad Medical. Then I ended up at Spectranetics and AngioScore. And guess what? Now I'm at Abbott. I've come full circle. Abbott, literally ACS, the original company I was with in the 90s, became Guidant. Guidant became Abbott. So I've come full circle.
Right.
It's really exciting, you know, making those pivot points in my career, because I really was following the technology and what was the next therapy. And I was very fortunate to jump at those the right times. So.
Yeah. I got to ask real quick, Guidant, did Anthony Caparso work for Guidant? Does that
the name sounds familiar.
Name sound familiar?
You know, Guidant was, you know, I was obviously on the vascular side, and obviously they had CRM as well, which is the management. He could have been over there. Yeah. The name sounds familiar.
Yeah. And Manny Villafano, is he the one? Okay.
Well, Manny Villafano invented St. Jude Medical.
Right.
And Manny is here in the Twin Cities. As a matter of fact, Manny spoke at SMMG MedTech and gave me St. Jude Medical about a year ago.
Okay.
Manny, he came over and talked at our venue, and he's the inventor of St. Jude Medical.
He owes me a podcast interview. We've talked a handful of times, and the time he just hasn't been right yet. But I remember he had something to do with some of those behemoths up in there in Minnesota. So
it's a great story. You definitely want to hear from Manny.
Just
a side note, when you talk to him, he also, there's a great steakhouse here in the Twin Cities called Manny's Steakhouse. Well, that was his as well.
I've heard of this.
And it's actually, he's no longer part of it. But when I interviewed Manny at Manny's Steakhouse, and he had a special table that we sat at.
right. That's funny. Giovanni, I forget his last name, from the Mullings Group. He did an interview with Manny at his steakhouse as well. And I thought it was pretty interesting. That's funny. Hey, before we talk about SMMG MedTech, I want to just add a quick question here. So you mentioned in your bio a distinct point where you went from really the sales business development to management. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, I think just from a career advice standpoint, you know, how do you know when to make that leap? You know, was there a thought process you went through? Because I think a lot of people go through that. I mean, I know me personally, I think sometimes of, I'd really love to, you know, get into management, but then I look at my week and my calendar and who I talk to, and I go, oh my gosh, I'm not going to talk to as many clients. I love this. So maybe talk about that thought process of how you made that decision, because I'm curious.
Yeah, no, good question, Dwayne. It is very important when you look at your span of your career of when you make, again, those pivot points, not only with companies or therapies, but also with functions, you know, as to you go from an individual contributor role into leading people. And I think for me, I had a really successful sales career with Bard and then ACS and then Heart Technology. And so when Heart Technology, the inventor of the rotablator, got bought by Boston Scientific, it was a good, I had now been selling for about 12 years, made a very good money. You know, it was a, you know, that's the other thing. Individual contributors make really good money. You jump into management and you don't necessarily make the kind of money that the really good reps make. So I always say, you know, a very good advisor told me once, hey, Zeke, at the end of the day, you can make the money on the front end, which is the commissions, or on the back end, which are the options. In management.
So right.
Take your pick, Zeke, but I think the options in the end will you know, pan out for you. And quite frankly, it did.
Yeah, right.
And the options I made and what the stock did.
At that time.
So what happened was my decision point came right about that time where Boston Scientific got bought out by Heart Technology. Excuse me, vice versa. Heart Technology got bought out by Boston Scientific. And so at that time, I was talking to my manager at Heart Technology, a very good mentor of mine, an advisor for most of my career. And unfortunately, he passed away about a year ago, but he really coached me through my career. And at that point in time, he told me, Zeke, hey, this is probably a good time for you to look at management. You've done well. You've sold for 12 years. You've been very successful. You've been president clubs winner, you know, reps of the year, all that kind of stuff. Maybe you want to think about it. Because at some point in time, to your point, Dwayne, if you don't make that move, you become kind of stagnant as an individual contributor and you're kind of there. Mm-hmm. And it'd be hard to pull out later if you've been doing that for 20 years. So 12 years seemed about a good time to interview. So I interviewed in that process. I remember I was living in LA. They flew me to Minnesota. It was December. It was freezing. I was like, God, who would ever live here? Who would know that I'd end up here? But I came in, I interviewed during that merger process with Boston Scientific, and I interviewed for the management job, and lo and behold, I got it.
Yeah.
That was the impetus for me to do it was, number one, I had a really good mentor coaching me. Manager at Heart Technology. 12 years seemed about the right amount of time to, you know, have been successful in sales. And then I jumped into management and had my first region management job. And it's still in Southern California, but for Boston Scientific.
Okay. Awesome. Great. I appreciate that. So let's talk about SMMG MedTech, what it is, how you founded it, and, you know, why people should follow it and know about it.
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, SMMG MedTech stands for Sales and Marketing Mastermind Group MedTech. Okay. That's what that stands for. It's a little bit of a mouthful, but I've had it now for 9 years, so I can't change it. But it's kind of getting its own brand. But SMMG MedTech, the reason why I founded it, I was, as I mentioned, I moved to the Twin Cities, you know, back in 99, knowing that maybe at some point in time, I would think about startups, right, and medical device, and maybe take a risk, you know, leaving a big company like Boston Scientific. So I knew there was an ecosystem here in the Twin Cities of a lot of, you know, med tech companies like, you know, Boston Scientific. SciMed was Boston Scientific. You had St. Jude Medical, you know, you had Medtronic. You have a lot of early stage companies, a lot of engineers that are thinking about things. So what I realized back in 2013 when I founded SMMG MedTech was that, you know what, there's a lot of talent pool here that if they met on a regular basis, really could learn from each other, almost like a think tank of executives that if they met on a regular basis, perhaps we could teach each other, have vision of leadership. And I wanted it more on the commercial side. Okay, I didn't want necessarily engineers. I didn't necessarily want clinical regulatory because it wasn't that type of environment that I wanted to learn from. I wanted it mostly commercial. So that's where you kind of had a sales and marketing background. Since that time, we do have some lawyers that are part of this and legal people and a couple of other functions, but really it's commercial executives. So sales and marketing background. Now we have CEOs, we have general managers, we have venture capitalists that are part of this organization. And it's really a networking society that meets once a month, really the first Monday of every month from 7 to 8 a.m. Central Time. And we have a speaker that comes in and talks about topics that are related to the commercial side of med tech. Okay. And as opposed to, you know, the regulatory side or what have you, or that kind of thing. So, and I started it mainly sales. So there were like four members. We met for coffee, right, in 2013, and it was four of us. And Jim Mayberry, who's now part of Edwards Life Science, Dave Van Horn, part of Boston Scientific, myself, Jody Brindell, you know, part of Medtronic. So we kind of sat and had coffee, and it was like very informal. Mm-hmm. And then I said, wait a minute, you know, maybe we should try to really formalize this thing and you know, have topics that are related to commercial and see if we can make something out of this. So I made it part of sales and marketing, not just sales. I think all of us were just sales leaders at the time. And now I added marketing to it. And we were meeting in a community room in a Byerly's grocery store here in the Twin Cities. And we would meet face to face. And then it kind of word of mouth, we grew to maybe 10 members. Okay. And then it got bigger to maybe, you know, 15 members. But we are still meeting face to face in person. At this community center. And it was, so therefore most of the members were based in the Twin Cities, right? And then I decided, you know what, this is really getting bigger than I thought it would. And so I really, first of all, it wasn't my full-time job. I was still working at different companies at the time. And so I said, you know what, I got to form a board. I formed a board of directors kind of 2 years later. Okay. And so that we would meet regularly. I then made it an actual nonprofit organization. And then I actually started charging an annual dues as well. Okay. It's nominal dues, $120 a year All of that funding goes right back into the organization. It's still a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. We don't make profit off it at all. And then we started growing and getting speakers. First, we were just talking topics. Then all of a sudden we started saying, hey, what if we brought somebody in to talk about
Right.
So that started working, and word of mouth started growing, and we started getting bigger. And on any given Monday, we would have maybe 25 members show up at a meeting in that community room. And then lo and behold, a year ago, COVID hit, right? And
right.
Nobody's meeting in community rooms. You can't meet face to face. So then we got together with my board, and I said, hey, you know, what do you guys think? And they go, well, hey, what about meeting via Zoom? You know, I mean, mm-hmm. It sounds like we could actually do that. So I started that, Duane, meeting on Zoom calls, still first Monday of every month, 7 to 8. But now I could record the call where I wasn't recording it. And lo and behold, I can get people out of the Twin Cities now, part mm-hmm. of it. So all of a sudden my membership started growing, and I got people now all over the US. I actually have international people part of it that were speakers that then became members. So there's members in England and in France that are part of SMMG as well. And we've really increased our membership based on COVID, believe it or not.
Right.
And it's not just Twin Cities based now. Now I will say 95% of the folks are Twin Cities based, but we are, you know, kind of national and international now as well.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, you touched on it, right? Minnesota, if you were a startup company and you decided you were going to start your company in Minneapolis, you would never have to leave Minneapolis for any resources, right? A lot of cities don't have that luxury. So it's nice that you're able to now expand that knowledge base. And if you want to tap into that and you're located somewhere like Cleveland, Ohio, you know, I could tap into that expertise because, you know, and I'm not saying other cities don't have resources, but it's they don't have what Minneapolis has. I mean, it is what it is. So it's nice that people are able to access that now. And COVID obviously is not a good thing, but a positive that has come out of this is people who maybe weren't inclined to network virtually had to do that. And I think they've started to see the positives of that now. I mean, you've seen it. You've grown your base because you've had to expand now. And all of a sudden people, I know Tim Blair is one of your members, and he joins from Florida every you know, session. So it is nice in that way. That's awesome. So you guys meet once a month. How do people join? They just go to the website or?
Yeah, good question. Right now you can go to the website, smmgmedtech.com, www.smmgmedtech.com. I just recently switched website designer. So we're kind of in the midst of putting more of that more automatic, if you will. Traditionally, they, you know, it's word of mouth. They talk to me. I email them the information. One of my board members emails the information. They, you know, sign up, they get dues, and then they get on the invite list every month.
Okay, great. So the main reason I wanted to have you on, you have a ton of experience in commercial. Something that startups are going to face, and they don't realize they're going to face it, is, you know, really, and Tim Blair said this yesterday when I interviewed him. So his podcast will be released just before yours, so it's good timing. The new valley of death is right after a startup company gets approval and them actually becoming a successful commercial company, right? So, you know, getting through regulatory, yeah, it's hard, but most companies are going to do it. Reimbursement, same thing. You're going to figure it out. But actually, you know, selling your product on the market, achieving even regional market access is going to be really, really hard, especially for 510K products, which like 90% of medical devices are. So, you know, you have sold at large companies, small companies, and everything in between, and you've been successful at it. So I really wanted to have you on to get those challenges and tips of, you know, how do you sell your product and when do you start thinking about it? So let's maybe start with challenges. You know, if I'm a startup company, I just got my regulatory approval, or even if we need to start thinking about this before regulatory approval. How do we overcome that challenge of actually being successful in selling this product on the market?
Yeah, good question, Dwayne. And to your point, I've been in mid-sized companies, large companies, and products that have not even sold a single thing yet and are in clinical phase. So it's I've been very fortunate to in all phases of different startups. And you know, one of the first things that you have to think about, you know, as a commercial leader, is that you know I've been in companies where you're still in clinical phase, right? You're finishing a clinical trial. You got to get enrollment. Everything's about enrollment, right? A time is money. If you don't get that enrollment, and the faster you get that enrollment, the faster you're gonna come to market. And then again, just because you get enrollment and your study finishes, it might not meet its endpoints. So right. Guess what? You might be out of a job, which happened to me in one of the startups I was with. But okay. To your point about thinking about the challenges ahead of time, depending on what your product is and the clinical aspects of what the product is doing, you have to make sure, number one, that clinical trial hopefully was written really well with good criteria, good endpoints, you know, sort of, you know, knowing what that endpoint's going to be and making sure that whatever this trial is and the way we wrote it in terms of exclusion and exclusion criteria is going to hit the mark. And if you do that correctly, you obviously then pick the right PIs, you know, the for this study. You have to pick the right centers. You have to get that enrollment, like I was telling you about, and then you have to follow the criteria because a lot of cases get thrown out if you don't do it right. And so, as a result, those early sites are really going to be your first customers. Okay. So if you pick, you know, if you wrote the trial right, you know that you're going to get those endpoints. And then you actually have the right PIs that are good podium speakers, good key opinion leaders that are going to talk about your products. And then you know that you can actually get them in commercially into those sites. And, you know, even, you know, having the IDN world of today and the GPOs, you got to get past all that too, you know, with contracting and that. But you know that if you pick those right centers in the clinical phase, that hopefully in the commercial phase, those will be your first commercial sites that'll be using their product. So that's the first challenge I would say is make sure that you wrote the trial correctly, you work with your clinical team, the executives meet regularly, they talk to their board of directors, and they make sure that that endpoint is going to get hit. And then number two, make sure that you pick the right PIs, the right clinical sites that you know that not only will they be good enrollers and good monitors that follow your criteria, but they also will be good first commercial sites that will then be using your product and speaking on the podium at meetings and so forth.
Okay. So before we go on to your next challenge, clinical sites, PIs, key opinion leaders. You know, another area I see companies fail at, and I really didn't realize this until I interviewed Craig Berkey, who works down at Nagel Reiter as well. He's their chief operating officer. And he used to run Interplex in Cincinnati. But one of the things he brought up was, you know, sometimes when you have a product, the initial reaction of a CEO is to go and get those PIs, key opinion leaders, clinical sites to be places like Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, you know, Harvard, some of these top institutions. And while that's great, they're only thinking about, you know, they're thinking about that top 20 to 10% of surgeons who maybe use their tool or doctors who can use their tool, but they're not thinking about the other 80%. And maybe there might be some more difficult clinical adoption there. So when you're talking about, you know, picking these sites, do you recommend that they, you know, yeah, you want to be at those top institutions, obviously, but how do you make sure that you don't get into the spot where, okay, these top 10 places really love your device, but you can't get any kind of adoption anywhere else because you're stuck here because only these select physicians can or are willing to use your instrument. So is that something you build in that strategy as well? Do you try to spread it around and that way, you know, you don't run into the issue of, well, great, we can only ever sell to these, you know, select few clients and we're not a platform technology. So we'll just spin our wheels and then we'll eventually be done.
Yeah, no, very, very good question, Dwayne. I think what happens is you do need, you know, as you're, especially in the startup world, you need those key opinion leaders in those key sites like a Mayo Clinic, a Cleveland Clinic, you know, so forth, you know, Columbia, New York, what have you. I speak most of my time I've spent on the cardiovascular side. I've done some on the neuro side and the stroke side as well, and some on the vascular side, closure side. But when I think about that, I also realize that those big centers like Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, and so forth, they do want to be in those studies.
Yeah.
You sort of need them, but their IRBs are also very difficult to get through. And they also take a long time. And I told you, in startups, it's all about, you know, time, right? And getting enrollment. So, you know, you've got to go through all their IRBs, and it could take a longer time in those sites. And by the way, they might not be your highest enrollers. You can get one of those community hospitals with a very good PI. I was talking about getting the right investigator, and they're running right through the studies. You know, a great example is an early company I was with called Coaxia. We had a device for ischemic stroke patients. It was called a NeuroFlow catheter. It was an infrarenal suprarenal balloon that went into the descending aorta and diverted blood flow to the brain. It was actually a very, very cool device basically could help ischemic stroke patients. Right now, the standard of care is IV tPA within 4 hours of symptom onset. This was a device that you could put in and put it up for 50 minutes and then you were done, and it could go 24 hours from symptom onset. So it was really exciting. But what my reason why I'm bringing up that company is that it wasn't just those big centers like the Cleveland Clinics and Mayo that could get it. We actually went to sites in Canada, in Alberta. I think our main PI, our national PI, was out of Alberta, Canada.
Okay.
We also had a small little site, Holston Valley in Tennessee, was one of our highest enrollers.
Yeah.
You know, and so we had a mix. And if we would have ever gone to commercial, it's a long story, but we didn't go commercial. We didn't meet our endpoints, ran out of money, had to sell the IP, and I had to get another job. Yeah. But at the end of the day, you know, if we ever did, you know, those centers like a Holston Valley small community hospital, but doing a lot of cases, could actually be a very good commercial customer right out of the gates versus a Mayo Clinic, which might take a little bit of time to get it going. So you need a mix, I guess.
Okay.
Need the top tier, but then you also need, you know, the ones that are churning and burning and doing a lot of cases. It could actually be a very good site as well.
Yeah, that's super helpful. I think that's good advice. Okay. So we covered that initial, I guess, you know, the timeline. What are some other challenges that they're going to face as they're commercializing their product?
Yeah, I think what you'll find is that you originally have a plan, and like anything, you know, you have a timeline and then it always gets longer. Okay. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately with startups, you know, you get to a point where you're going to keep having to raise money. You know, you get diluted. And so you better have those plans ready to go, because quite frankly, Duane, 9 out of 10 startups don't make it. You know, they really don't. They end up running out of money, or they don't meet their endpoints, or something else happens. But the ones that do, then, you know, they become Heart Technology Rotablator and get bought by Boston Scientific. Or right now, a really good one is Shockwave, which is an intravascular lithotripsy that early stage, way valued high right now, almost $3 billion valuation, which is ridiculous on maybe 60, 70 million in sales. But the hype has brought them up, right? And it's a good company. Don't get me wrong. I know a lot of people there. But at the end of the day, you've got to have, excuse me, plan A, plan B, plan C. Mm-hmm. And you might have to go and pivot. You know, you might have to do another study. You might go before the board. Let's say it's a PMA approval. You have everything ready for the PMA. You had your consultants coaching you all along the way to get approval. You go through the PMA and they turn you down. Mm-hmm. Now you got to do another study. You got another 3 years. You better have some more money raised to go do it. A little bit easier with 510K, as you mentioned, but you have to make sure that you have that plan. Even if you're a commercial company, an example is a company called Neovasc here in the Twin Cities. They have a device called the Reducer for refractory angina. It's actually a therapy to treat that. I actually know the CEO and the COO of that company. They're actually speaking at SMMG MedTech next week.
Okay. Cool.
With that, you know, they had a plan to go to market. They went in front of them, got their PMA. They had really good speakers on their behalf. Unfortunately, they didn't get the nod. So they're a public company. Their stock went down with that. And they were able to, the good news is they were able to raise more money, and they're going to do a new trial in the U.S. but it's still 3 years away now from the US coming to market.
Right.
They are selling in Europe, so they're getting revenue. They do have revenue in Europe. But you have to, my point is, as leaders in that company, you have to make sure that you had a plan B. You know, you thought you were going to get that PMA approval. It didn't happen. So that means they had to go raise more money, which means the common shareholder gets diluted. And you know, that's the way it works. But the good news is they're still around. They also have a couple other devices. They have a new TAVR device, et cetera. So companies that are startups have to make sure that, you know, there is a money trail that is going to last a lot longer than what they think, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's important to almost, you hate talking about worst case scenarios, but you have to understand where they are. If they do present themselves, how do you pivot? And having that elaborate, and that's your job as leadership, CEO, whatever it is to understand, okay, if this trigger point happens, we need to pivot this way and we have to be ready to do that. And the more nimble you can be, the better you're going to be. And startups have to be there. They have to be there. And even if, you know, if you go into a medical device company and you think, well, I'm going to exit, I think that's a poor strategy. I mean, it's okay to want to, like, you should, most companies are going to want to exit. No, I mean, obviously, but you need to, if you're going to go in, you have to expect that there's a good chance I might have to commercialize this a little further than I think. And if you always have that in mind, and if an exit comes sooner, great, good for you. That's awesome. But you have to be prepared to do that because strategics, if your goal is to exit to a strategic, what they say today could change in a month. I mean, let alone 5 years from now. So, you know, don't bank on that. I've talked to a lot of people who sit there and say, well, yeah, we're already in talks with so-and-so and they really like our technology and all you have to do is meet this endpoint. And I tell them, yeah, well, I've heard that story before. And I've also heard the same strategic go, well, yeah, I know we said that before, but now we want to see you do this too. You know, and that timeline just keeps getting kicked down the road. So just be cautious of that because it happens a lot more than people think.
No, you're exactly right, Dwayne. You have to have a commercial strategy as a startup. You have to have the go it alone strategy, and then you could have the strategic strategy. You can have the exit, get, mm-hmm. you know, go IPO. But even when you go IPO, that doesn't mean it's an end game yet either. You know, right. And now you're beholden to shareholders and. You got your quarterly meetings, et cetera. You got to meet those milestones publicly.
Right.
Sometimes when you're private, you can still do strategic moves and be more nimble.
Yeah.
So the way you exit matters as well. And when the strategics do get involved, you know, it doesn't mean they're going to acquire you. Sometimes they just have a board seat, not a voting right. And they just sit there and they, you know, they're listening and they're you know, they gave you funding. So they're on the board. They might not have a voting right, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to acquire down
yeah.
the road.
Yep. Okay. So let's talk about, one more challenge. Cause I know we had talked about this before, and then I want to get to tips, because this is going to segue nicely into the podcast that gets released the week before yours. So, you know, proprietary products have their own set of challenges versus me too products. I talk about me too products a lot. And you know, those are 510Ks and, the challenges that you might face if you're a 510K versus a de novo or a PMA. So maybe talk a little bit about those challenges as well.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, when you look at the proprietary technology, and again, I'll go back to the example of Shockwave, it's an intravascular lithotripsy. That was novel, proprietary. Nobody else had it. Back in the day when I was at Heart Technology and Rotablator, same thing, an atherectomy device, orthogonal displacement. Those were proprietary. Those you could raise a lot of money. You could actually get it to market. You could go commercial. You can hire great reps that have great relationships, and we're able to get those devices into the hospitals and into the GPOs and IDNs. But then you have the Me Too products that could still do very well, but they, you know, it might be a little bit harder because they aren't exactly the sexy products that, you know, are more technical. like a TAVR device or something like that. And I've been in both. You know, I was in this, you know, the rotablator world, but I've also was with a company called Interrad Medical, still in existence today, that had a securement device. This was a radiologist friend of mine, Dr. Mike Rosenberg, who invented it. And I came in to commercialize that that company. They had never sold anything. You know, they thought they were going to be bought out in 4 years. Well, that was, you know, 15 years ago. They're still independent. Okay. But so they had to have a strategy to keep raising money. They're not public. They didn't go exit. You know, the original strategy was, you know, get the securement device, you know, into the hospitals and grow the market. But, you know, when you're a small company, you don't have the bandwidth and commercial size. So you can get the interest, but ultimately you want to sell to a Bard or a Teleflex or an Arrow and put it into their pick kit and sell it that way. They call it the Intel Inside strategy, you know, a Pentium chip in every computer. You wanted a SecureCath in every pick kit.
Right.
Me too product, but it was a little bit novel to a StatLock, which was a securement device. So, but the challenge there, Dwayne, was, you know, you thought we could go, you know, US market, get it going right away. And it turned out that the better strategy was go to Europe, because a PICC line stayed in longer, and it was more economical to use a SecureCath device that actually stayed in for the life of the line.
Okay.
Excuse me, a StatLock, you had to change out every week. So that was caught, you know, a little bit more cost conscious in the US market. So because the Europe market didn't use ports like they do in the US, that means that really was more economical out there. And so we went and set up distributors very quickly. We literally went out there ourselves, kept flying across the pond and basically established foundation accounts ourselves. Mm-hmm. We're shipping across the pond, didn't have a distributor, because we wanted to make sure when we got a distributor, we already had some foundation accounts for them to go to.
Sure.
We sold it the way we needed to. We had the features, the benefits, all the things that needed to be done. Then we could turn it over and say, oh, by the way, here's your accounts in England. Here's your accounts in, you know, Amsterdam.
Right.
So that's really important, to not just go out and get distributors, but maybe do it yourself first, establish foundation hospitals, even in, you know, internationally, and then go get the distributors to sell your product.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. You know, the Me Too products are, I guess in my mind, and I haven't sold medical devices, right? I've been in business development, but on a CRO side, so it's a little different. But to me, looking at, you know, 510K Me Too products, it is a tough dance, because you are proving substantial equivalency when you're talking about your regulatory, and then you go and you know, talk about reimbursement or selling it, and you're like, well, I understand that our thing was that it's substantially equivalent, but I'm telling you, it's this much better. You know, it's like, how much can you really, you know, I guess move the needle there. It's gotta be a little bit tougher of a sell. So I appreciate that insight there. I think that's helpful for most startups who ultimately have Me Too products. So the other tip that we had talked about before, and you had mentioned this, it was, you know, new products, they take longer now. And Tim Blair just talked about the importance of fractionalizing your initial team, whether that's engineering, regulatory, reimbursement, clinical. And we got into, and it wasn't really a debate because we ended up agreeing, but it was, who's your first hire? He went on a technicality and said, it's a CEO. And I was like, well, no kidding. I'm saying, if you're the CEO, you know, who is your first full-time employee? And I've never run a startup company. So this is just from me working with startups and observing. I've talked to a lot of people in the industry and, you know, companies that are successful, not successful. And to me, it was, if you're the CEO, you can fractionalize, you know, the clinical person, the regulatory person, even your CFO, you know, a lot of those reimbursement, a lot of those areas, even engineering to a certain extent. Maybe you make an argument for engineering as a full-time employee, especially if you have a platform technology and you really want that person to grow with you. So I can get maybe your chief technology officer being your first one. But my argument was, your commercial person, should be your first full-time hire. The person that, if you're going to have to spend a bunch of money on someone, you bring that person in to support, because all those steps are great, but you have to be able to sell this, and it takes longer. It's, you know, so I've seen some things that say 10 years for product adoption from most doctors. So my argument was it should be a commercial person. Tim ultimately agreed that's what he would do as well. Because if you can't sell it, it doesn't matter how great your product is. It'll never see a patient. And that's really the ultimate goal of why you start a medical device company, is to bring innovative technology to patients. And, you know, I know that's not like an ideal world. If you make a great product, it should sell itself, but that's not real life. You know, that's not the real world. So that was my argument, is it should be a commercial person. I'm guessing you probably agree because you're a commercial person, but I'd love your thoughts.
Yeah, no, actually, I've never really thought about that. I'm glad you bring that question up. And as I listened to what you and Tim were talking about, there is arguments for that. Because initially, if you would have asked me that question before I just heard what your response was, I would say that the bulk of startups, you know, have a founder, right? And mm-hmm. that founder is many times a physician in the med tech right. world, okay? The founder, sometimes an engineer, but many times a founder is the physician himself. Mm-hmm. Came up with the idea, he got the IP and so forth. Obviously the CEO is gonna, you know, be, you know, the board really selects who that first, employee is. And most of the time, point, you gotta have somebody, yeah. right? But after the CEO, you know, what's the function you wanna go for? And I would say originally, my thought, depending on how technical it was, it would have been engineering, because, you know, that founder has the idea, but he has no idea how to make it. Okay. Mm-hmm. If they're a doctor, you know, they have an idea, they know what they want it to do, but they don't have any idea of what it's going to take to make it. Okay. Mm-hmm. So getting an engineer as one of your first, hires, if you will. And again, as a startup, you can always parcel all this out. There's so many different consultants out there. You could
write
consultants for a while. But, and I know NAMSA does that, you know, originally and so mm-hmm. forth. But you know, that engineer is so important, because if you can't make that product, yeah, you need somebody to be able to sell it. But if you can't make it, what are they going to sell?
Right, right.
So I would argue that maybe engineering is still very critical in an early stage, mm-hmm. because you've got to be able to make it. And once you make it, then maybe I could argue commercial is the next aspect. And usually it's someone more with a marketing background. You know, not necessarily sales, but marketing, MBA, you know, those kind of guys that, you know, have done business development, know how to commercialize, and eventually some of those guys end up becoming the CEOs as well, mm-hmm. of companies. So you would argue that commercial would then be next after engineering. I guess it just depends on how technical that product is, but you yeah. better have a commercial strategy. And the companies that wait too long, to your point on commercial, you know, let's say they say, hey, you know, I'm not going to commercialize for 3 years. What do I need, you know, a VP of sales and marketing for? Well, you know, again, I came in with that early stage company still in clinical trial, but I helped with enrollment. I helped with strategy. I helped with, you know, how can we increase enrollment? You know, let's work with the clinical team, but let's do it this way, that you sell the trial like you sell a product. Okay. Right. And those folks might not think of it that way. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that commercial expertise in the beginning, early stages of the startups helped, because we were selling the trial like we sell a product.
Right.
That role is probably pretty critical. Let's call it engineering commercial, close to close in terms
of. I like it. Yeah. I think something that's important is, you know, a lot of times these really early on, these really early startups, these physicians, engineers, whoever might be the founders of these companies, you know, a lot of times there's some that say, hey, I want to take a stab at being the CEO to start, right? And they might hire an engineer at first. And if that's the case, it's important that you seek some type of commercial consulting as well. Because the most dangerous thing you can do when you're building your prototype is do it in a vacuum. And if neither one of those first employees have commercial experience or marketing, it could be really, really dangerous. You can make a product that's really cool that can't be manufactured and it can't be sold. So it's really important to get those pieces of the puzzle at the very beginning. while you're building it.
I'm listening to you as you say that. And the company that comes to mind right out of the gates is a company called Light Labs, which was a bunch of MIT engineers that developed OCT, optical coherence tomography, with imaging. And they came out with a really cool device, but had a lot of bells and whistles.
Yeah.
And they were all engineers. And so they thought, I could do this, we could do this, we could do this, we could do this. But man, to try to sell it and have the end user use it with all of these different features, it's very difficult. So it wasn't until St. Jude Medical bought Light Labs that they were able to then turn it into more of a image with less bells and whistles, more user-friendly.
Right.
Had the commercial expertise of St. Jude Medical. And then, of course, Abbott bought St. Jude. And that's actually a product I sell today. Abbott. And even today, you know, 20 years later from Light Labs or 10 or what it is, we have to, you know, dumb it down, if you will, quote unquote, to make sure that the end user, you know, has all these bells and whistles, but they see it as user friendly. Now we're going into artificial intelligence with it. It's actually an incredible therapy. That is really a startup therapy in a large company like Apple. It's kind of fun selling it because, you know, if it was independent Light Lab still, you know, that's all you'd be focused on. Obviously, we still focus on stents, we focus on physiology, we focus on other product lines, structural heart, et cetera. But at the end of the day, you know, that commercial early stage, if it was just engineering, it might not have ever made it. You had to have that commercial expertise to figure out how to get it to market.
Okay. Awesome. Well, great. So we covered a lot of the topics I wanted to cover, but I also had a few other, I don't know, a hodgepodge of other ones. You brought up networking, the importance of networking. And I had a guest on, in January, his name was Frank, Agin, and he's not a medical device person, but he is a networking expert, and it was someone I wanted to have on because I truly believe that networking is so important, not just for your career, but even in the jobs you do. I mean, I can't tell you how many times a career move for me was made, and I've only made one coming out of pharma into medical device, but, you know, from going from NAMSA to Covance, launching my own thing on the side. But the people, you know, is just so beneficial for your individual career. But even, you know, once I'm at these companies, the networking is so important. I've seen it with just, you know, figuring out, okay, if I really know this person really well, they might give me 5 or 6 leads a year. Great. So maybe talk about networking in your career, but then also helping you be successful in whatever job it is, whether it's CEO of a medical device company, whether it's sales, business development, whatever it is.
Sure. No, I am a strong, strong believer in networking and networking early on in your career. From that standpoint, Duane, it really was kind of the impetus of starting SMMG MedTech, right? I mean, it is a networking organization, and you really touch base. If you ask my members, what's the number one reason they're part of SMMG MedTech, it's going to be networking. Number two would be, you know, speakers and topics that are related to what I want to hear about. But number one reason that they are part of this group is to network. And, you know, early on in my career, I learned that you've got to network, and you got to have people that are what I call your AAA list, okay? You should, and I actually coach young sales reps. I was just interviewing somebody yesterday for a job, and I said, you know, the one thing, you know, do as you start your career is create the AAA list for yourself. And what I mean by that is you wanna have a advocates of Zeke, acquaintances of Zeke, and allies of Zeke, okay? And I literally do this. I have a spreadsheet, and I've done this for almost 25, 30 years, where I have, these are my, you know, acquaintances of me. These are my, allies of me, and these are my advocates. Okay, and you can actually graduate these people from acquaintance to advocate to ally. Okay, ally being the best because they're going to recommend you. They're your mentor. They're your advisor. They're going to take you on. But then, most importantly, what I do with this list is I look at it every quarter and I make sure that, have I touched base with them. And if I have, where have I done it? Oh, at a TCT trade show. I texted them. I had coffee with them. I interviewed them. you're part of my AAA list now, Duane.
Okay.
We had a podcast together.
Right.
And as a result of having that AAA list of yourself and your career, when you make those pivot points, and I've made a lot of them in my career, it's because of the network. I can't even tell you, how I got the job last from a recruiter. I mean, not that I put anything against recruiters. They're very, very right. important in our industry, but I've gotten it usually because of somebody I knew that recommended me. I came back to Abbott because the division vice president was somebody I knew and I worked with before. Mm-hmm. My current boss is somebody I've known for almost 30 years. So that network all the way back from the early 90s of the AAA list of Zeke actually helped me today in my career, 25, 30 years later.
I like that. I like that a lot. I think it's something that, I give a lot of thought to as well. And just, for me, it was when I was starting out, it was find great mentors. And they should be in different areas, right? Like I had a mentor at NAMSA, Don Pohl, when I was in biological safety in my really technical role. And he taught me so much. And then I had a mentor for regulatory and it was Angela Mallory. And then, I had a handful of people that I just looked up to and almost tried to emulate, right? I don't know if I've ever even told Tim Blair that, but Tim is someone I've always looked up to, right? I think the way he saw medical device development, when he would talk to me about it, it just made so much sense. And it was like, okay, I really need to, stay in contact with him and continue to learn from him. So I think making that transition to, figuring that out is not just who can help you network better, but also people you can learn from, is really important. We talked about that yesterday is listening. Just listen to people, people spend a lot of time talking over or talking to instead of listening. And I that was like one of my biggest pet peeves when I was starting out was there were people in leadership roles who talked at me and there were people who talked to me and listened. And I'd much rather, be with the latter than the first. So no, I think that's a really good advice. I like the strategy of it. I've never really thought of doing that. I think I have like a mental AAA list, but I think I need to get that down on paper. It's a really good idea. Yeah. Cause you do forget to check in with these people. Sometimes life happens, things get busy. I think I was probably better at it 3 months ago before my daughter came along.
Well, you know what it is, Wayne, too. Now with social media, it's a lot easier to do it.
Yes.
So that's the other thing is that you have, LinkedIn, Twitter, what have you. So those venues or modalities, if you will, to connect are even easier. It's so much easier to stay networked now because of that. But still keeping it your own AAA list. I'm a firm believer in it, and I coach many of my teammates to do that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, so to wrap it up, let's great books you've read, you recommend, you are reading. I wanted this to be a question I ask all my guests, but then I started to realize maybe not everyone is an avid reader like myself. So I do read a lot, and it's mostly nonfiction. So talk about some books that were influential for your career, and then other books you're reading currently.
Yeah, no, thank you. One of the first ones, and actually kind of that AAA list sort of came from the first book that I read way long time ago called The Art of Tactful Self-Promotion.
Okay.
What was in there was that you're in a company, let's say the size of Abbott. Well, there you're going to have different what I call snapshots in front of leadership, right? Well, mm-hmm. you have to know how to act, tactfully self-promote yourself. First thing you're going to say is how are things going, right? Well, you could just say good. Well, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Instead, you say it's going good, and let me tell you about what just happened at St. Mary's Hospital. We've just put this modality in here. We did this. Now they have a snapshot of you with an actual example.
Right.
Have to artfully, you have to do the art of tactful self-promotion. That was an early book. The other one I told you I'm a big networker is Dig Your Well Before You're Thirsty. Okay. If you're networking because you're in between jobs, that's too late. You got to dig that well before you're thirsty and make sure you have your AAA list. And you could have gone, you've already been keeping in touch with all these people, and you're not just calling them now because you need a job. You know, so that was a very influential book as well. And then the other one is You're in Charge, Now What? You know, I've been in leadership positions, you know, running sales organizations. You know, be careful what you ask for. You're now in charge. Now what do you do?
Yeah.
And you better know what to do. And I learned different things early on that when I'm the, you know, an executive leading a bunch of people and employees and teammates, what you need to do is you need to understand their motivations, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the very first things that I do, and I learned that from You're in Charge, Now What, is that I send out right out of the gates when I ever take over a team, you know, I ask them a bunch of questions, five different questions. You know, what do you hope that I do? What do you want me to do? You know, what are some of the things that are the most influential resources that you need to do your job? And I have them fill this all out. And then my last sheet is, here's a bunch of motivational factors. What motivates you? And I list about 30 different things like praise, money, you know, promotion, you know, culture. And I tell them, rank the top six out of 30. And I need them in rank order. This is what motivates you. Because you know as well as I, Duane, everybody's motivated by different things.
Right.
No two people are alike. It's like a snowflake. They all look different, right?
Yep.
And so unless I know what their motivation factors are, how can I lead them?
Right.
Because they could be thinking that they're motivated by money, or I could think that they're motivated by wanting to get promoted, when in essence, they're more motivated by culture, or they're motivated more by benefits, or they're more motivated by, you know, the space that they're in. And if I don't know that, how can I lead them?
Right.
And so those are very, very important things to know, is the motivational factor of the people that you're leading.
Okay. I like that. Are there any other books that you're reading just out of curiosity? I mean, interesting ones.
Yeah. The current one that I'm reading right now is called Extreme Ownership. And it was actually written by a couple Navy SEALs.
Jocko.
You're familiar with it?
Yeah. Jocko Willink.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And yeah. Basically, it's the leader has extreme ownership, right?
Yep.
He talks about how he used his military background and now he coaches business leaders.
Yeah.
And how you have to own it.
Yep.
And you have to make sure that, you know, at the end of the day, if something's not going right and you keep blaming this person or that person or that person, at the end of the day, you better look in the mirror because you have extreme ownership. And at the end of the day, the buck does stop with you. And you better take ownership and change what you're doing.
It's a good book. I read it a little while ago. The other one that you should read is Stealing Fire.
Okay.
Hold on one second. Yeah, it's called Stealing Fire, and it's written by Stephen Kotler and Jamie Wheel. It's pretty much its subtitle is How Silicon Valley, the Navy SEALs, Maverick Scientists Are Revolutionizing the Way We Live and Work. It was a good book. I don't remember when it came out, but I read this a couple years ago, and it was really good. So I recommend that one, especially if you like extreme ownership.
Thank you.
So awesome. Well, listen, hang on for a second. We'll have a quick discussion offline, but I'll stop the recording portion of it. Zeke, I really appreciate you coming on. I thought this was super helpful. It's an area that I don't, my expertise lies in that initial first part of a lot of this. It's not really in actual selling the medical device. So I really appreciate the insights, and I think you gave a lot of good nuggets for listeners.
You're welcome. I very much enjoyed it, Duane, and thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you need anything from the podcast, you can always contact us at info@projectmedtech.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.